Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 341, recorded on January 12th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, just me hosting this week. We're going to be talking about Charles Joseph Bonaparte. This is our bonus episode this week, which is unlocked again to encourage people to subscribe to our new Patreon. On Arsenal for Democracy, we've been periodically doing feature episodes on specific personalities and celebrities of the American progressive movement of the turn of the last century. And this week, we'll be looking at Charles Joseph Bonaparte of Baltimore, a reformer of that era who was nationally regarded as one of the cleanest and most virtuous political operators in the country, as well as a smart and energetic lawyer and a compelling and funny orator. Now, to help me talk about one of our American Bonapartes, I brought on a special guest, Everett, the host of Age of Napoleon. Everett, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know, Age of Napoleon is a history podcast that is really excellent, covers the sort of whole history of the life of Napoleon Bonaparte, Napoleon I, in starting out in Corsica and then taking over France and then much of Europe. You can check that out at ageofnapoleon.com. But although you go really quite far back into Napoleon Bonaparte's history, the branch of the family that we're going to be talking about today is descended from one of the figures that you haven't really gotten into a whole lot of detail about. And I don't know if you agree with this characterization, but to my mind, Jerome Bonaparte, who's the head of this branch of the family, so to speak, the youngest brother of Napoleon, is sort of kind of the odd one out in that founding generation. There's obviously a second generation of people, as we'll talk about as well, but within the founding generation of the immediate siblings of Napoleon, kind of the odd one out. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who Jerome Bonaparte was and how he ended up starting this non-dynastic American line of Bonapartes.
Sure. Well, I think you're absolutely right to call him the odd one out. He's certainly one of the least written about of the Bonapartes. Much younger. When Jerome was born, Napoleon was 15. So their relationship was really almost more of like a father-son relationship because Carlo Bonaparte, who was the father of both of them, died the year after Jerome was born. So he never knew his father. The only father figures he ever had in his life were Napoleon and Joseph, his older brothers. And he had a very different upbringing than the other Bonapartes because he was so young. The Bonaparte family had been, before the revolution, minor gentry. They had some noble privileges and some degree of influence and power in their little town in Corsica, but not very much money. And, you know, they lived in a backwater of the kingdom. So they were not high on the totem pole. But Napoleon's success started in his early 20s. So for most of Jerome's childhood and young adulthood, you know, he was the younger brother and sort of, you know, surrogate son of a famous general and politician. So he was actually raised with power and privilege in a way the other Bonapartes were not. And kind of the consensus among a lot of historians is that kind of spoiled him a little bit. Napoleon seems to have believed that too, actually.
Now, he was raised in that context, which was different from the other siblings. And in some ways, he was spoiled, so he was kind of doing his own thing. But in some ways, he kind of had to do whatever was for the benefit of the rest of the family. The other siblings ended up, as the transition happened from this sort of dictatorship to a more conventional royal imperial family, they ended up all kind of marrying off to different members of the European nobility, more or less, and becoming royals for the most part. Although, was Lucien ever a royal? I don't think so, right?
No, he broke with Napoleon at the wrong time to get a title.
So how did Jerome even end up in the United States?
So Napoleon's dream was to have a sibling in the Navy, because that was kind of the one area of, you know, sort of official French institutions that did not have a Bonaparte family member in it. So he put Jerome on that track at a very early age and saw to it that Jerome was commissioned as a naval officer. Then there's the famous expedition to Haiti. Well, infamous, I guess. And Jerome was part of that. I don't want to spoil too much because that's what I'm talking about on the show right now, actually. But that turned into a complete disaster. And a lot of the members of the expedition, well, the ones who survived, ended up kind of scattered around the New World. And Jerome, you know, being someone who was kind of inclined to take the easy way out, decided he was going to go lay low in America for a little while. And of course, for Jerome Bonaparte, laying low meant going to parties where he was going to be the guest of honor, going to big society balls, being, you know, feted by all of the American elite. He was in, you know, the newspapers constantly. So he did not really lay low in the United States. It was more of a publicity tour. I should mention he's very young at this point, like in his late teens. In the course of this tour, he meets Elizabeth Patterson, who is a stunningly beautiful, very ambitious, from a very good family. A lot of people remark that she pursued him. She saw him at a horse race, and apparently the sight of a Bonaparte in America triggered something in her, and she thought, you know, I have to marry this man. And so she pursued him, and within only a few months of them meeting, they were engaged and got married.
Now, that didn't go over very well with the boss man back in France, his brother Napoleon. Do we have any indication? Did Jerome think he was really going to get away with this? I mean, it seemed like he came back to Europe thinking that he was going to get the retroactive stamp of approval, that this was a don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness situation. It very much was not.
Right. Yeah, Napoleon was apoplectic. I mean, this is like, you know, the Bonapartes were, you know, the subject of all kinds of gossip, and they were celebrities. So this was kind of like the big Bonaparte family scandal of this era, this, you know, scandalous American marriage. And Napoleon did not make a secret of how upset he was about this. And, you know, he made noises about arresting them, and he maintained, and he did have a point, under French law, you needed a parent's permission to get married under the age of 25. And so Napoleon was very adamant that this was not a real marriage because no permission had been sought or given. But Jerome and Elizabeth seemed to have genuinely believed that if they could just talk to Napoleon, it would all be smoothed over. You know, Jerome had been totally bowled over by this woman. I mean, she was very charming by all accounts. And so I think he really believed as soon as he sets sight on her and sees how beautiful she is and talks to her and sees how, you know, intelligent and witty and charming she is, he'll agree. And so for like years, there was this back and forth between the brothers. And of course, I mean, you know, diplomats are involved and stuff, because by this point, Napoleon's the dictator of France and then moving on to being the emperor of France. So it's a matter of state as well as, you know, personal family matter. For years, throughout all of this back and forth and ugly stuff in the press and diplomatic maneuverings, Jerome and Elizabeth were still convinced if he could just meet her, it would all go away. It shows you that this was not a marriage of convenience or anything. You know, he really was smitten with her and really believed that she was that wonderful that his brother would just instantly retreat from this very public position if he could only see how great she was.
I think it's interesting as well that this, again, showing the generational sort of gap within that first generation, if you compare to, say, Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's older brother, he married a merchant's daughter, very similar, basically, to what Jerome was trying to do, except, you know, for the United States. But by the time he did that, that was now a big no-no because it was, you know, there was a plan for the whole family at that point.
Oh, yeah. And that was typical of Napoleon's relations with his younger siblings. Joseph and Lucien were in one category. Everyone else was in another category. You know, it's one of the sides of Napoleon that is, in some ways, it's touching because he really did see himself as like a father to these people and cared about them quite a bit. But he was so controlling and so obsessive about keeping them on the track, you know, he had laid out for them. which, I mean, he was genuinely convinced that people need to do what I say so that they can be happy, and I'm smart, I've got it all planned out for them, I need to just make sure they follow the plan. But it must have not been very pleasant. And you can certainly see it, I think, in the behavior of a lot of his siblings. I mean, living in this guy's shadow was not a comfortable place to be. They all struggled with it. Jerome, his struggles were a lot more public than the others.
Now, Jerome's marriage ended up being ended from his perspective. His wife never apparently really recognized it as having ended. And from what I could tell, and what we'll talk about, is that the American branch was raised to be quite devoutly Catholic. Napoleon had a bit of difficulty untangling the situation as well from the religious side.
Yeah, Napoleon, classic Catholic fashion. Napoleon, his first impulse was, we can just get it annulled. And so he went to the Pope and said, hey, my brother made a mistake. You know, I need you to undo this. And it probably didn't help that Napoleon actually lied to the Pope. Napoleon, he presented this as like, oh, it was this quickie Protestant ceremony, strongly implying that they'd only gotten married so that they could have sex. And then the Pope looked into it, and it turned out, no, it was a real wedding, like a bishop presided over it. So Napoleon probably took the wrong tack by lying to the Holy Father on that one. And the Pope said no, originally. And it actually turned into a bit of a diplomatic incident between France and the Vatican. Fortunately, you know, Napoleon never let that put a stop to him. I don't want to get too deeply into it, but, you know, he had special rights over the Catholic Church in France and over family law in France. So he just had the marriage annulled, you know, civilly in France, under the grounds that it had been, that there had been no parental permission and they were under 25. And then eventually when Jerome and Elizabeth returned to Europe, Napoleon had Jerome arrested and then basically leaned on him until he signed a letter basically reneging on the marriage. So, I mean, Elizabeth had a point. That's not a divorce, right? That has no legal force under American law. So they were in kind of a gray area. And that's why Elizabeth and then, you know, subsequent generations of that family were able to keep up that kind of hope that they would one day kind of be included with the rest of the family.
Yeah, and if people want to know more about the papal-French relationship under Napoleon, you've got some great episodes on Age of Napoleon that go into a lot more detail about that. I know that, as you said a few minutes ago with regard to Haiti, which you're covering now, that you've got some stuff coming up that relates to the Americas, and so I don't want to get too far into that, but can you give us a little bit of taste from your show of what's going to be coming down the pipeline in terms of U.S.-French relations during this time period on the whole? I'm assuming that this was also seen as kind of a scandalous outcome from the United States side that probably didn't endear the Napoleonic regime to certain powerful people in Baltimore and Washington. But I don't know what, you know, this was happening around the same time as the Louisiana Purchase had happened and so forth. So is there any other context people should be aware of for that sort of relationship at the time?
Yeah, so Napoleon in America is like a very... Americans were very much of two minds about Napoleon. On one hand, people really admired him, like his personal qualities. You know, he was a genius, a man of action, a person who had rose on merits, which obviously had a lot of resonance in America, being a Republican society. And in the very early stages of his career, he was really worshipped in America, almost kind of seen as a French Washington. Obviously, that changed when he took dictatorial powers. You know, eventually when he became emperor, that was obviously abhorred by people who were staunch Republicans in America. But there was still that germ of admiration for him, but also he also had turned into this kind of ogre figure, almost seen as a symbol of despotism and a failure of liberal ideals. But that was complicated, of course, because we had foreign policy dealings with him, because his big enemy was Britain, who was also our big enemy at that period. And then, of course, there's the there recently had been the quasi-war with France. So French-U.S. relations were at a very complicated moment during all this. And obviously, the marriage with Jerome, and then, of course, they ultimately had a child. The marriage between Jerome and Elizabeth, you know, then became kind of a proxy in these bigger debates about, you know, should America look to the continent or to England as a model? And, you know, should America be aligned with France and foreign policy, or should it only be like a co-belligerent against the British? And there was actually a lot of worry that Napoleon did at one point have ambitions of a French empire in North America, centered in Louisiana. That went out the window with the failure of the Haiti expedition, but that worried Americans quite a bit. That was a real deep existential fear at that time among the American elite that we would be kind of boxed in, I guess, by some European power taking the West away from us. So these two 18-year-olds getting married, you know, on one level, it was almost covered like a celebrity story. But there's also these undercurrents of, you know, you can read like Federalist newspapers at this time saying, you know, there's a throne being made in Paris that Napoleon wants to install in Washington and put his little nephew on it. So, you know, it was beyond being a kind of light celebrity story. There were these political implications to it as well. You can see it in the overheated press of that era. There's all kinds of paranoid fantasies about what this 18-year-old girl and her baby might mean for the future of America's political system.
So let's talk about that baby now, who launches this line of Bonapartes in the United States, who subsequently rose to prominence. I mean, a little bit because they were affiliated to Napoleon, but, you know, the Napoleonic folks in Europe mostly did not regard them as being dynastic. So that son that you just mentioned, produced from that annulled marriage between Jerome Bonaparte and Elizabeth Patterson, was named Jerome Napoleon Bonaparte. He was born in 1805, nicknamed Beau. For the convenience, I'll continue to refer to him as Beau just because there's a lot of people with similar names in this. And he apparently, his whole life, was obsessed with the Napoleonic stuff. The guy that we're going to be talking about for the meat of this, Charles Joseph Bonaparte, was not particularly interested in the Bonapartes, and the Napoleonic family generally spoke in condemnation toward them. People would try to sell him relics and curios and memorabilia, and he wasn't into that. But his father, Beau, did have apparently a lifetime habit of trying to collect stuff and always kind of hoping that he was going to be welcomed back to the family, which never really happened. So Beau, in 1829, married a Baltimore heiress, another one, Susan May Williams. Her father was, among other things, a rail tycoon, an early rail tycoon with the New Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company, which was one of the first real railroads under construction in the U.S. at the time. Interestingly, Beau died in 1870, a few months before the collapse of the second Bonaparte regime in France, which was, of course, Napoleon III, one of the nephews of Napoleon I. And Beau had two sons. The first son, Jerome Napoleon Bonaparte II, was born in 1830, and he died in 1893. He graduated from West Point in 1852. He served in the U.S. Army until 1854, and then he left for France to serve in the Second French Empire's army under Napoleon III, who, as I said, was his father's first cousin. He got along relatively well, apparently, from what I could tell, with the sort of Generation II folks in the Napoleonic side in Europe. He served in many of the Second Empire's wars at the time, some of which were quite prominent, and he was regularly writing home to his family in the U.S. Then that government, the empire, fell in 1870, at which point he returned to the U.S. He then married into the prominent American political family of Daniel Webster, and he had a daughter who married into the European nobility and had a whole line from there. She was probably sort of the most legitimized back into the European circles, I think. And then he also had a son who, this is just interesting to me, married someone from Newton, Massachusetts, which is where I'm a city councilor. So I kind of thought that was funny when I saw that. The male line of Bonapartes in the United States died out, unlike that daughter who went off to Europe, interestingly. But now we come to the second and quite a bit younger son of Beau, the non-dynastic grandnephew to Napoleon, Attorney General Charles Joseph Bonaparte. He was born in 1851, quite a bit later than his older brother. And he's the person that I wanted to talk about because he's such an interesting, sort of strange leading progressive figure in the United States. And as I said, not very pro Bonaparte in general. There's a whole bunch of links that will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com with this episode and up with the Patreon upload of this episode if you want to take a look. But the bulk of a lot of the sourcing that I found was an interesting biography called Charles Joseph Bonaparte, His Life and Public Services, which is from the 1920s. It's in the public domain. And this was written by Joseph Buckland Bishop, who was, as Charles Joseph Bonaparte was, part of Theodore Roosevelt's inner circle. And he was also the authorized official biographer of Theodore Roosevelt. So some of this is going to be a little bit more glowingly in praise of Charles Joseph Bonaparte, but that's okay. You know, it was interesting. And it's, I think, a good counterweight as well, because as we'll talk about, there was, for reasons that will become evident, there was a lot of press hostility toward Charles Joseph Bonaparte because of his agenda. If you just went on the basis of that, you would get a very incomplete picture of who this guy was, because a lot of it was just completely fabricated. So as I said, he was born in 1851. So his brother was already, you know, off at West Point and about to graduate and go into the military service. Charles Joseph Bonaparte probably ends up being the most influential of the American Bonapartes. He's a high-ranking progressive political figure at the turn of the last century. His critics referred to him as the Imperial Peacock of Park Avenue, but as I said, really did not affiliate himself to the Bonapartes other than having the name. And the thing that I wanted to get your thoughts on is that, and we'll talk about the specific elements of his career and his agenda, but he was this turn of the century progressive or liberal, however you want to call it. He was supporting education, supporting meritocracy, that kind of thing. In many ways, I was thinking about what you've talked about on the show with Napoleon and his sort of economic policies, his legal policies. Obviously, a man of many contradictions, trying to resolve the liberal rationalization and meritocratic impulses of the revolution with trying to get a sort of more conservative segment of society on board and at least okay with his regime. He's also working at kind of the beginning of the first industrial revolution. You still have very small sort of industrial base with not a whole lot of factories and certainly not people owning a ton of factories. By contrast with Charles Joseph Bonaparte in the United States, we're talking about someone at the height of and in the aftermath of the Second Industrial Revolution dealing with these monopoly corporations owning tons and tons of factories. So I was wondering, before we get into kind of the details of what he was working on, if you had any comments on these sort of parallels or contrasts between sort of their agendas and what they were trying to pursue.
Yeah, I find that a really interesting comparison for two reasons. First, I've often wondered what Napoleon's career might have looked like if he had been born into a society where he could have advanced, you know, on merit, with a society like, you know, like 19th century America, where a person born into relative privilege, there wasn't really much stopping them from, you know, achieving great political power and influence. And I often wonder if Napoleon had been able to pursue that stuff just through the normal political process, would he have been drawn to politics, and would he have been just a conventional politician? I do think that looking at the fact that this relative of his did follow that track, it makes you wonder if maybe, you know, if he'd been born in, say, the United States 50 years later, or in Britain 50 years later, you know, maybe he would have just been a, you know, a relatively well-known member of parliament or member of Congress or something. And the second thing is, you know, like you said, you know, this era that, you know, our Bonaparte was born into is much more, it's not just the industrialism. This is a world much more ruled by ledger books and bureaucracies. It's much less of a kind of romantic, heroic era than the world Napoleon lived in. And I wonder if that fact might have helped kind of channel his impulses away from, you know, autocracy and conquest and towards more kind of, well, more conventional and less aggressive ways of achieving your goals. I do wonder if he'd been born two generations later, if this might not be what Napoleon's career would have looked like.
Yeah, and I think we also have this interesting parallel between these two brothers, where Charles's older brother goes on the conventional sort of military track and ends up serving in both the U.S. Army and the Second French Empire's army, whereas this younger brother, born almost two decades later, growing up during the Civil War and its immediate aftermath in this Unionist family in Baltimore, he ends up becoming just basically a wealthy attorney who could take on pro bono cases for the poor, take on wealthy clients as well. You know, as you said, this is after that sort of paperwork revolution or clerical revolution, which I've talked about on this show, because literally the invention of typewriters and cheap manufactured paper from wood pulp is not in the distant past from Charles Joseph Bonaparte, whereas that had not happened yet during the first French Empire. So certainly an interesting contrast. But also a lot of the stuff that Napoleon did pursue, even after he, you know, kind of became this dictatorial figure making peace with the conservatives, still was relatively interested in pursuing kind of legal rationalization and meritocracy as an objective of like an improved French state. And one of the things, as we'll talk about with Charles Joseph Bonaparte, is that his overriding belief was things would be substantially better if we just had more meritocratic and fair processes in the government, as opposed to everything being corrupt patronage networks and who you know and things like that. I mean, yes, he had his famous last name and he had his wealth from his mother's side of the family and so forth and his grandmother's side of the family, but he was still convinced that the real secret to unlocking American potential wasn't going to be some sort of sweeping revolution. It was going to be just like, we just need to make the government work better for people who are talented.
Yeah, and there's a lot of resonance with Napoleon there. Napoleon, it's funny, he often is painted as this kind of opulent figure, but he was never terribly attracted to wealth. He actually kind of despised that quality in people when it led them to break the law. That was weakness. He famously dismissed his personal secretary for using his name in business deals. That was to Napoleon, that was over the line, to have someone mention that they work for him in a business deal. It's funny that seems to be a through line in a lot of the Bonapartes, even the extended family, is that they genuinely believed in public service. I mean, they wanted to be the person at the top in that public service, but they believed in the mission of trying to improve people's lives through public service. They really despised corruption and despised people who used public service for personal gain. It's interesting how that you see that with conservative members of his family. You see that with liberal members of his family. It seems to have been, I don't know, some kind of Bonaparte family value.
It's also interesting, though, that one big difference is that Charles Joseph Bonaparte at certain points was approached for pretty significant high office, even potentially floated as a presidential name, and he just absolutely did not want that. I mean, he was surprised to even end up in the U.S. cabinet, which we'll talk about, but once he was in the cabinet, his only aspiration was to be the U.S. attorney general, and that was it. He really did not want to hold any sort of elected office, and he probably could have. I mean, as we'll talk about, he was genuinely so popular and charismatic that he often overcame absolutely incredible smear campaigns from the media and his opponents and was still, you know, just this totally beloved figure in Maryland by ordinary people who supported his sort of reform agenda. So let's talk a little bit more about Charles Joseph Bonaparte. He became interested in political reform while he was attending Harvard. He had tried to get a little bit involved in campus politics, which is also a familiar theme today, given how much gets talked about campus politics for some reason by actual grown-up politicians and commentators. But anyway, he decided that campus politics at Harvard were basically stupid, corrupt, and anti-Catholic. As I said earlier, he was a devout Catholic in the liberal tradition. And interestingly, you know, I mentioned earlier that he had kept up a close correspondence with his older brother when he was serving in France. And Charles found that the U.S. State Department was very reluctant during the Franco-Prussian War, as the second Napoleonic government was collapsing, to actually send those letters to his brother, either from him or from his mother, while he was serving in the French army. And Charles attributed this to bad civil service workers, telling his mother, quote, "The government exists solely for the good of professional politicians, and its places are filled by such persons as are too dishonest or too imbecile to find support in any other manner." And so this factor sort of launched him on this career of promoting reform of government in general, and also specifically civil service reform, which is going to be important to this story and his sort of rise to prominence nationally. So he became very involved in the politics of Baltimore, Maryland, his home city, after he returned from college and had eventually gotten married as well to someone that he met, I guess, at a baseball game that they were playing at Harvard. Somebody had come up, you know, with her friends to visit, and they became introduced that way and so forth. And of course, their families, both being relatively elite families, already kind of knew each other anyway. But in 1885, so this was, you know, about a decade and a half or so after his brother had returned and, he had finished out at Harvard and so forth, Baltimore was widely regarded as rivaling New York City's level of ambient corruption, like that people were like, you know, as Tammany Hall and also the Baltimore machine. And those were seen as the two sort of most corrupt and egregious machines in the country. Charles founded the Reform League of Baltimore and waged a 10-year campaign to bring the progressive Republicans to power. Every time they were defeated, he would use that to prove that widespread electoral fraud outright was happening. And he finally did succeed in 1895 in toppling the Baltimore Democratic machine in a clean sweep after reformer activists had put immense pressure on the Democratic governor of Maryland to appoint Bonaparte as one of the three supervisors of elections. He actually was constantly overruled by the other two supervisors on basically everything, but he just kept on filing and publishing minority reports on everything. And then there was sort of this emergent new free press that wasn't explicitly associated with one political party or the other. Now, of course, as we're going to talk about later, a lot of them newspapers ended up being affiliated with various corporate interests. But there was this sort of brief window where he had a very good relationship with the local press, the free press in Baltimore, and they were advocating as well for that clean election process. And they publicized what the election laws were, and they told people what would happen to you if you got caught violating them. And that was apparently enough of a deterrent that they started being able to actually hold free and fair elections in Baltimore for the first time ever. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, for or against the newspapers play an important role in Charles Joseph Bonaparte's life. And I've noticed that's a theme on your show, Age of Napoleon, as well. Different situation, obviously, and a very different situation with the actual process of how newspapers got made and circulated. But Napoleon was very adept at sort of manipulating the press in certain ways. And we see, I think, flashes of that as well with Charles Joseph Bonaparte here. I mean, the master of giving a killer quote to a reporter, getting those reports out there that he wanted circulated, getting people to actually read them and come over to his side on something.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Napoleon kind of came along sort of at the beginning of this era. In fact, he was one of the pioneers of this, you know, that style of, you know, almost governing through the newspapers. And then now here you see it, you know, at the height of that period. And it is, you know, it is really remarkable. And it's hard to underestimate just how powerful newspapers were in this period. I mean, there were so many of them. So many people read them. I mean, it was not at all uncommon for people to regularly read more than one every day. And when you look at how people who understood how that system worked were able to manipulate it to their own ends, it's really fascinating and kind of frightening in a way, because you think that, you know, our media is, of course, descended from this media. So, you know, the ability to manipulate has not diminished over the years. But yeah, it is his great uncle pioneered it, and here he is practicing it.
This would have been also a few years before the whole newspapers manufacturing consent for the Spanish-American War as well. I think that's worth noting contextually in terms of how important this was. So Charles Joseph Bonaparte, in his reform agenda, advocated not only for the election reforms in Baltimore and Maryland as a whole, but he also advocated specifically for the civil and economic rights of Black Baltimoreans, often representing them in court as well. Even later, when he was serving in the U.S. cabinet, he would show up in Maryland to campaign on these issues. And he, for example, publicly denounced a proposed constitutional amendment that would have added a grandfather clause to disenfranchise most Black voters. And again, he was one of the most famous people in Baltimore at the time, and he pointed out that that would also make him ineligible. Maybe not because he had a grandfather on the other side who was a citizen, but, you know, at least on one side, he had a Corsican grandfather in Jerome, Napoleon's youngest brother, and that's not a good enough reason to take away someone's right to vote. He continued to campaign against that proposed constitutional amendment for years until it was actually defeated permanently. As I said, he often represented the pro bono cases of the poor in court. He seemed to enjoy a lot of those cases, and in some cases, you know, would stay in touch with clients for the rest of their lives. There's a number of other notes that I'm going to skip over here for time reasons, but again, they'll be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com or with the Patreon episode in a PDF, so you can take a look at those. There's some interesting other observations that I had found about his role in Maryland politics. So his reform agenda mostly focused on election law, as I said, and it was considered to be relatively pragmatic in terms of reforms. Obviously, this is a period, as I've talked about a lot on this show, of great ferment and socialists and anarchists floating various sort of revolutionary ideas, and even some of the progressives that were campaigning for various constitutional amendments at the state and federal level had some pretty out there ideas. But as I already alluded to, he really was seeking in many ways to make the existing laws and government systems actually be implemented legally and cleanly and function, as opposed to making major idealized reforms to their form. Kind of the most dramatic example, you know, which goes to show you how conservative he really was on some of his approach to this, is that they borrowed some ideas from the Australian electoral system for making fair elections in Maryland, but that was really about it. Like, that was about as extreme as they went in terms of shopping around for potential kind of ideal government reforms. He really worried that if you deferred reforms of existing systems to try to come up with some idealized new mechanism that you were then going to have to explain to people how it was even supposed to work, as opposed to just saying, here's how the system we have is supposed to work and it's not working, here's how we can fix it, he thought that nothing would change if you kind of pushed it off on that. I found there was a 1900 speech that he gave in Concord, Massachusetts. He was explicitly praising the conservatism of the American Revolution compared to other revolutions. I don't think he mentioned the French one specifically, but it was understood. And basically trying to correctly enforce the laws and customs already in existence in the English colonies, just like the Declaration of Independence, claiming that all the problems were because King George was trying to change things. His praise was that they didn't try to change things significantly or have a reign of terror or whatever. And I thought that, you know, even if you set aside sort of the Jacobin period of the French Revolution, it's definitely undeniable that when Napoleon took power as the head of state in France, that he did undertake a pretty sweeping reform of the actual systems, even down to the ground level, with the things like the Napoleonic Code and so forth, which you've done an episode or two on as well on your show, right?
Three, I think, actually.
Three. So what do you see a contrast here, or do you see more of a similarity in terms of trying to kind of reconcile the need for reform with the need to kind of balance things and not go in an extreme direction between him and Napoleon?
Well, you know, I know that that line was extremely popular among liberals, progressives, Whigs, whatever you want to call them, like the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's a very old idea that there's kind of two types of revolutions, the good type and the bad type, and the ones that really disrupt things are the bad type, and the ones that kind of make incremental change are the good type. Well, the problem with that is that's not how things unfold. You know, no one sits down around a table and says, hey guys, are we going to have the good type or the bad type of revolution? These things are dictated by events and conditions. And actually, if you look at Napoleon's correspondence, he was a great admirer of both the British and American systems. And he spoke of them as if those were kind of the ideal systems. But he didn't believe that was possible in France, basically because of the conditions of the monarchy before. And I think he was right on that. That, you know, people always asked him why he couldn't have been like Washington, who was one of his heroes. His response was always, I would have loved to have done that. But it wasn't an option given what the circumstances were in France in 1799. I gotta say, you look at it on paper, you know, you can agree or disagree with what Napoleon did, but when you look at the state of the country when he took power, the idea that he could have brought into being a system like the American system, you know, the ship had sailed on that like a decade ago. We're all prisoners of history. I don't think that was on the table for him to have a good revolution. I don't think that was on the table for France, really. So I don't find that a fair criticism, but I find that a very unsurprising sentiment coming from a progressive of that era, because that was kind of orthodoxy for those type of people in that period.
So Charles Joseph Bonaparte was also involved in the National Municipal League, and he was a founding member of the National Civil Service Reform League, and this is going to be very important for the rest of his life. This organization had existed since the 1881 assassination of President Garfield in a dispute over government appointments, and they continued as a significant force for federal government reform through World War I, and then also even into the post-World War II civil rights movement era. Many politicians and party hacks, unsurprisingly, were still at this point in Charles's life opposing civil service reform because of the advantages to the patronage system, and that put many of them at odds with him. But as we saw from those letters to his mother back in college, he was convinced that the need for reforming the civil service and making it meritocratic was imperative to the future of the United States. And it was through the National Civil Service Reform League, starting in the 1880s, that he became friends with Theodore Roosevelt, another guy who was, you know, not astronomically rich, but from a prominent family and wealthy enough to be able to spend his free time pursuing all of this, you know, reform work instead of, you know, having to work for a living necessarily. And Roosevelt went on to serve as New York City's civil service commissioner before, of course, rising through the ranks to become vice president and then president. Charles eventually served as the national chair of the National Civil Service Reform League, and they worked very closely together when Roosevelt was deployed to Baltimore to investigate corruption in federal offices there on behalf of Congress. So by the end of the 19th century, Charles and Theodore Roosevelt were quite close. So of course, in 1902, he joined the Republican federal administration under Roosevelt after the assassination of William McKinley. First, he was on the Board of Indian Commissioners. This was arguably the lowest point of the commission in its entire history, just a few years before it was significantly shaken up by reformers with an interest in improving the dire conditions on reservations. Now, the biography kind of credits some of his work in triggering that push for reform. I'm not really sure if I agree with that. He was a special inspector for Indian reservations, and he made a report that said conditions in the Indian territory involve immediate danger of ruin to the genuine Indian population and profound discredit to the United States, excite reasonable discontent on the part of all classes the population, and demand prompt and drastic remedies on the part of Congress. And supposedly, according to his biographer, this report led to radical change on the government's Indian policy. I found some other things that indicate some other people may have been more important in that, but that at least gives you some indication. However, I would say that we would not classify his opinions on indigenous people as being particularly woke. I think they were more in the French Catholic colonial tradition than, say, the British or American tradition. But there was still a view that mainly the condition of the natives was the fault of them not having Christianized and not having civilized to compete with the white people when they first started arriving. In 1903, he served as a special prosecutor for postal or mail fraud. And as I alluded to earlier, he was floated at this point for a possible Senate run for the state of Maryland. He quickly declined, implying that he felt potential candidacy for elected office would present conflict of interest in advancing his lifelong mission for clean elections. And later, he similarly rejected being floated as a presidential candidate. He did agree, however, to serve as a presidential elector, however, which brings us to a particularly interesting election again in Maryland history, and one that immediately reminded me about the all the Napoleonic plebiscites that both Napoleon I and the III were fond of. Kind of a contrast to that, I guess. In 1904, Maryland held a strange presidential election, and I found a great write-up on this from the Maryland State Archives that was published right after the controversial 2000 U.S. presidential election. Right off the bat, like, Teddy Roosevelt gets elected to his own term easily by the rest of the country. That's not really in question. But Maryland itself did not get their results back immediately, because this was held with secret ballots paid for by the government instead of party-line open ballots paid for by the political parties. But this was the first time ever. Again, that's only back in 1904, really not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. I think there's often a mythology around American elections and how they were conducted. This, again, really was the first truly fair and free presidential statewide election in Maryland history. As I said, paid for by the government, secret ballots, etc. This was new and kind of confusing for some of the voters. And additionally, they were asked to cast basically a non-binding vote, as far as I could tell, on the popular vote for the presidential candidates, but then you still had to pick the individual electors, which resulted in kind of a strange outcome. The counting process took weeks, basically until the end of November. Theodore Roosevelt was counted as the winner of Maryland's non-binding popular vote statewide by 51 votes. However, he didn't get all the electoral votes because people had to vote for the electors individually. There were 8 electors. Only one Republican was chosen. That one Republican was Charles Joseph Bonaparte. Most of the other Democratic electors were equally famous to him in local or state politics. That may have contributed to them having the name recognition to defeat the rest of the Republican slate of electors, despite having voted for Roosevelt to be reelected in the non-binding vote. But I think this is at least a testament to the personal popularity and name recognition of Charles Joseph Bonaparte by 1904 in the entire state of Maryland. He was certainly at least as well known as all these other figures who were people like governors or party leaders and things like that on the Democratic side. So even though this was still a solidly Democratic state at the time, with pretty significant machine control still at this point, he was at least able to overcome that in this kind of unusual election. So I was wondering what you thought in terms of this parallel or contrast that I was thinking about here, this notion of free and fair elections, which was the lifetime cause of Charles Joseph Bonaparte, as opposed to his relatives across the pond being pretty obsessed with these non-free and non-fair elections.
Yeah, it's but that, what a strange story. I was not aware of this until I saw your notes, and it really hammers home what a slippery concept democracy is. Napoleon's plebiscites also very undemocratic in a very different way. And it really hammers home the way that, you know, we have a very set idea of what democracy is. But there was a lot of searching around and kind of trial and error before people really got that clear picture. You know, you look back in history on some of these earlier elections, and sometimes you really kind of struggle to understand even what the point was of holding an election at all, if it was going to be such a strange, undemocratic fashion. You know, it goes to show you that, you know, so much of this is about impugning legitimacy on people rather than, you know, genuinely kind of going to the people.
Right. And I think it's interesting, too, though, that if we look back at the history of 19th century elections in the United States, yes, there's people tend to remember things like the racial disenfranchisements or the fact that women couldn't vote. But in many cases, you know, it took until the late 19th century, if not the 20th century, to have secret elections where you had to not show your ballot to anyone and things like that. You look at the histories talking about Napoleon I or Napoleon III, and it's just, well, look at how undemocratic these regimes were, holding these referendum votes to confirm what they wanted. Then, you know, everyone's vote was public information, and what a scandal that is. And, you know, that's totally undemocratic. And you look at how the 19th century United States was often holding elections, and even setting aside the problems that people do remember, there were all these other things that really didn't represent democracy as we would currently understand it. So he wasn't necessarily hugely far off in the French regime, or I guess both of them weren't particularly far off in terms of how to conduct elections in a manner that was considered the standard at the time, I guess we'll say.
Yeah, and you know, let's not forget that, you know, as weird as that story is, compared to the way elections would have been like around the time Charles Joseph was born, you know, Election Day in America was like a war zone. You know, there are armed gangs on the streets, people getting kidnapped and then drugged and taken to the polling places to vote multiple times. I mean, it's really anarchy. I mean, people would be afraid to go outside on Election Day, and for good reason.
Yeah, he talks about that in some of his letters to his mother. Certainly, this is, you know, when he was in college, was during the Reconstruction era, and he was off at Harvard, but there was a lot of chaotic situation in the post-war Baltimore period, and I've put some notes and references in them there for people to look at in more detail. But yeah, as he noted, there were murders that sometimes happened that were related to electioneering. The Maryland State Archives article talked about rival politicians or machine figures grabbing people, and two people grab one person and take them in opposite directions at the same time, trying to give them a ballot if they're lucky, and maybe 10 ballots crumpled up together to look like one ballot and so forth, and say, no, you got to vote for this one and not vote for this one. And they had all kinds of problems too. Even with this new ballot system, people were confused as to how to vote for Congress, so they had a lot of undervoting, although that was at least an improvement over previous elections, where certain precincts would have disparities of hundreds of votes between how many people had signed in to vote versus how many ballots turned up in the box at the end. So this was certainly an important reform. And as I said, sort of one of the major goals of Charles Joseph Bonaparte's life was this idea that we had to have free, fair, and secret elections, which had not been previously the norm. So opponents tried to smear Charles Joseph Bonaparte as a new political machine boss in Baltimore due to his perceived close influence with Roosevelt. But he soon departed for Washington to join the cabinet in President Roosevelt's second term. Charles first served as the U.S. Navy Secretary from the middle of 1905 to the end of 1906, supporting Roosevelt's push for a larger American Navy, and at certain times trying to introduce some of his reformer spirit to the sometimes sketchy naval military justice system. There was an incident where they tried to, you know, sweep something under the rug that was clearly partly the fault of a captain, because the captain was a more important person, and he said he wasn't going to stand for that, and that caused a little bit of a stir. But I noticed there were some interesting reactions to his appointment to be the naval secretary, and I was wondering what you thought about that. There were some remarks in the press kind of commenting on his relationship to the much more famous Bonaparte.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is not at all surprising. You know, you look at the way this guy conducted his life, and if he had any other name, you would never in a million years think this person would, you know, have a dictatorial impulse or a impulse to conquer or dominate. But he does have that name. And it shouldn't be forgotten that that did happen. When Napoleon III came to power, that was not his first attempt to seize power in France. So that was still relatively fresh in people's minds, the Second Empire. So I think, you know, maybe it's not so much of a leap for people to think, you know, maybe there is something about this family. Maybe there is something about that name that pushes people to these things. So I don't find it surprising. It does make me feel bad for him, because he clearly didn't deserve it. That was clearly not the kind of person he was. But, you know, it's politics. People are going to, you know, if that card is there to play, people are going to play it, even if it doesn't really fit. So I don't find it surprising, but it is kind of a bummer to read about this guy, you know, who seems to have really not had, you know, like I said, not had that conquering impulse. But when your name is Bonaparte...
Right. So one of the cartoons that was published at the time showed Napoleon getting a telegram from President Roosevelt. "I have made your grandnephew Secretary of the Navy." And Napoleon replies, "I hope he does better with ships than I did." Well, pretty good burn. According to the biography, one of the more interesting comments upon his appointment came from Constantinople in the Levant Herald. And of course, Ottoman struggle with Napoleon is a major subject of some of your earlier episodes on Age of Napoleon. The quote from that was, "Never was the truth of the saying about the best laid plans of mice and men more forcibly illustrated than by the news that the repudiated scion of the imperial Napoleon is to become a cabinet minister of the greatest republic the world has ever seen. As Secretary of the U.S. Navy, Mr. Bonaparte will command a fleet vastly more powerful than that of the great uncle who disowned him." So that was an interesting take on it. After serving as the naval secretary, which he wasn't super happy about being the naval secretary, he did it again, I think, out of an obligation toward public service and his personal friendship with Theodore Roosevelt. But he really wanted to be attorney general if he was going to be in the cabinet. And so he was eventually appointed at the end of 1906 to be attorney general in a position that he served until the end of Roosevelt's term in March 1909, at which point Taft became the president. And in that capacity, he gained the nickname Charlie the Crook Chaser. For his trust-busting work as Attorney General, continuing the work of his predecessors under the Roosevelt administration, for example, targeting the tobacco industry and so forth. I found a few interesting quotes from the biography that kind of give us an insight into his approach to this. He kind of went back and forth a little bit on some of the trust-busting stuff before he was in the actual position to prosecute them, but he took to it with some vigor when he was in office. So here's one, an October 1906 speech. "Our big, strong, greedy, over-prosperous trusts are animals of the pig order. They crowd their smaller and weaker fellows from the feeding trough so that they don't get their fair share of our national prosperity. The problem is how to fence off these giant beasts as to give the little ones a show. Remember, we don't complain of the trust because they are themselves big and fat, but because they keep the others small and thin. The fatter the big pigs become, the better for the owner, and the more money the trusts make, the better for the American people involved, provided in the one case all the little pigs get fat too, or at all events as fat as these can. Our president wants, and always has wanted, a square deal for everyone, whether pig, lion, or man, and under his leadership of the Republican Party has tried to put and keep each of our trusts in its proper pen, where it can't crowd any of the little fellows around it. To these ends, he has asked the aid of Congress and of the courts to keep the corporate and individual wealth of the country in due subjection of the law, not to make rich men poor, for to do this would only make the poor men poorer, but to make rich men law-abiding, so that poor men may become rich if they will. And the two houses of Congress, as well as the courts, have responded to his appeal." So you can kind of see his philosophy there, where it's pretty typical of many of the progressives, although maybe not, again, going as far as some of his fellow progressive movement people, in terms of, well, we're not really trying to cut down the rich to size or cut down the size of the trust necessarily, but it's really crowding out the competition with these smaller entities. And of course, you know, you and I know that from sort of a more Marxian economic analysis, it is an inevitability that the big ones are going to necessarily stomp out the little ones, and you can't really just fence them off from each other. That doesn't really work. And so, of course, he ended up, you know, pursuing a more vigorous trust-busting approach once he actually took office. A newspaper report upon his appointment stated, "He is an aristocrat in feeling and deportment. He is too proud to be bossed and too cynical to be fooled. No interest or no person does or can control him. Whether he is ambitious or not, in the sense that most men who get into high office in the United States are, is a question which even the very few persons who are his intimates are able to answer. They give it as their opinion that he would rather be attorney general than president, and that with his natural hatred of vulgar and greedy rich men, he will prove a terror to every trust magnate in the country who comes under that head." I thought that was an interesting sort of reflection on his personality compared to a lot of the rest of the Bonapartes, certainly. Bonaparte helped Roosevelt keep his nerve on antitrust policy during the financial crisis of 1907, which tycoons tried to use as a pretext to moderate policy action against him. Roosevelt and Bonaparte even agreed on a proposal to threaten federal receivership for corporate malfeasance, which I think seems like something we should bring back today. And they often spoke to one another about whether or not it would be possible to prosecute and convict high-level executives successfully instead of always finding some guilty underling fall guy. That was less of a question. I mean, partly it was a political question, obviously, that they were debating back and forth feasibility, but also they were finding that a lot of these executives were smart enough to kind of cover their tracks and not get caught doing some of this stuff. And that was frustrating to them. And they kept on trying to find like an ideal test case that they could go after. And I don't think they ever really did find one exactly. In March 1907, Bonaparte said, "It has been the aim of this administration, an aim pursued with unswerving fidelity during the past 2 years, to show all Americans, whether rich or poor or of whatever class, class, or condition in life that the laws made for their common good demand the prompt and unquestioning obedience of all alike. Similarly, in December 1907, he said, Americans as a nation think their laws are meant to be obeyed by all alike, by the rich no less than by the poor, by the enlightened no less than by the ignorant. Moreover, they wish and intend their laws to be thus obeyed, and that the richest lawbreaker who ever crushed out competition through a trust shall find no greater favors from courts or juries or public prosecutors than the meanest criminal who counterfeits our coins. Again, you can kind of see here his attitude is less about taking down the rich people because they're rich, but at least in rhetorical framing, saying this is really about making sure that everyone is equal and that those poor folks that he often represented as an attorney have the same sort of treatment in court as these rich tycoons with all their attorneys and so forth. Unsurprisingly, the pro-trust newspapers who were hostile to Bonaparte waged a relentless campaign to suggest that he did not get along with President Roosevelt and was always on the brink of being fired. But they had been friends for decades at this point, and Roosevelt privately often expressed to Bonaparte admiration for his work and his, quote, teamwork with the rest of the cabinet secretaries while mocking the false reports. Friendly journalists told Bonaparte directly that their publishers had handed down orders to get him out of office to stop the trust busting. Bonaparte himself often publicly mocked the press attacks, which tended to infuriate them further. And this part's one where I was reading it and I was like, all right, this is a pretty sunny biographical depiction here by someone that's clearly part of their inner circle and friends with all these cabinet secretaries. But on the other hand, you can look at the letters and it is very clear that they were very, very firm friends, even well after they were both out of office. There was never a point in their administration where it was even in doubt that he was going to continue the work that he was doing. Interestingly, also, a lot of journalists started having more friction with him because although he continued to give all these speeches and write columns and things like that, and he was definitely out there and talking to the press and communicating with the public, he often wouldn't tell them who was going to be getting prosecuted. And that was the thing that they, if they couldn't stop him from prosecuting people, more than anything else, they wanted to know who he was going after. And he was very careful to not talk about that until, I think, basically the day that he left office. And his argument there, which makes sense, is like, yeah, the companies that aren't getting prosecuted want to know so that they can get people to buy their shares, knowing that it's not going to tank when a prosecution is announced or something like that. You know, and I'm not going to sit here and benefit these businesses. Plus, we might later come after them. So he was pretty tight-lipped about that, which I thought was interesting. But eventually, people started to piece together which cases were being worked on, especially as he was leaving office when he actually announced and said, this is the list of the prosecutions that I'm handing off to my successor, which he did in a funny joking way, which made them even angrier. He had a pun for every single one of them. The one I want to talk about here was American Tobacco Company. He said, up in smoke would be the outcome of that case. They kept on trying to say, oh, he's just joking around and not taking this seriously. He's a real, you know, lightweight and so forth. And anybody who actually knew him and had practiced either alongside him or against him in court knew that that was not true. And he was very, very active and involved in all the cases on a personal level as attorney general. But I want to talk briefly about the American Tobacco Company. And then there's one other thing we should talk about his tenure as attorney general. So by the time of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, the ATC had come to control almost the entire tobacco industry of the United States with over 150 factories, having been one of the earliest companies to combine all of the post-Civil War investment money that was floating around with new manufacturing technology for machine-rolled cigarettes, so you didn't have to hand-roll them, and obviously that saves you a huge amount of costs on labor and so forth. In 1906, Charles Joseph Bonaparte began preparing litigation basically as soon as he took office as Attorney General to break them up. That took 5 years to complete, even after he had left office as Attorney General. In fact, there were 7 major antitrust cases that he handed off to his successor. The Supreme Court ordered the ATC broken into 4 companies in 1911 on the same day that they broke up Standard Oil, which had been launched as a case in late 1906, the month before Bonaparte became the Attorney General. So the last thing that I wanted to get into with you about his tenure as Attorney General is something that he is sort of the most famous for in retrospect, which is his founding of the Bureau of Investigation, which became the forerunner of the FBI. And he did that in 1908. So one of the things that you've talked about recently, and it's a recurring theme on Age of Napoleon, is Napoleon Bonaparte's relationship to secret police and so forth. So I was wondering what you thought were the parallels or not in this case. This is something that he is relatively famous for having done, was starting the BOI.
Yeah, it's funny. Napoleon's relationship with the secret police in Napoleonic France is controversial. You know, some people see him as, you know, a master user of secret police and a forerunner of, like, totalitarianism even. And, you know, there's a reason that they say that. The French secret police were pretty fearsome. I mean, these guys were veterans of the revolution, so they all had a lot of blood on their hands and a lot of experience, you know, with cloak and dagger stuff. But, you know, if you kind of read between the lines and read a lot of history, they undermined him quite a bit. His police minister, Joseph Fouché, was actually kind of a power in and of himself who Napoleon couldn't always control. I think it's very ironic that the FBI has played that same role in American history, you know, like during the Hoover period when he was kind of a power in and of himself out there that presidents couldn't quite control. And in fact, sometimes he tried to control them. So I think it's ironic. The organization was founded by a Bonaparte whose great uncle had been, you know, bitten by such an organization. From what I can tell, Charles Joseph probably was not looking for models in that history. He seems to have been pretty clear on his desire to break with family tradition, even when he didn't always, as we've seen.
Right. I mean, you know, when he was in the Naval Department telling someone in a letter, I have made it a rule for a great number of years, never under any circumstances to acquire by purchase a relic or memento of the Bonaparte family. He also refused to really even write about them. It was not a topic of his speeches or anything like that, even though he would often talk about Charlemagne or some other, you know, major historical figure or Charles I of England. Like, he could pull people, you know, at the drop of a hat, and he seemed to never really reach for that in his speeches.
Yeah, I mean, it's on one level, it's a shame because, you know, there's a lot of rich stuff there, but it must have been very, very hard and very strange to live with that name. I can only sympathize with his desire to not talk about them.
So as we wrap up here, when Taft took office as president, he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be able to keep you on as attorney general. And Charles Joseph Bonaparte said, oh, I didn't think I was staying on. I guess some of the other cabinet secretaries apparently did. But he said, no, I'm out of here. Like, I've done my service. So he very happily retired to practice law in Baltimore. And he continued to campaign for clean government in Maryland. And he supported Roosevelt's Bull Moose third party challenge for president 4 years later and so forth, remained very close with Roosevelt until, you know, until the end. He never had any children. He passed away 100 years ago this year in 1921. So that brings us to the end of our episode on Charles Joseph Bonaparte, this fascinating progressive reform figure from United States history that really does not get enough attention. I could not have done this without your help to talk about that Bonaparte connection, how we even ended up with American Bonapartes. Everett from Age of Napoleon, ageofnapoleon.com. Thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about Charles Joseph Bonaparte and the extended family.
Well, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
This is our bonus episode this week, which is unlocked again to encourage people to subscribe to our new Patreon. The address for that, if you're listening to the unlocked instead of the bonus, is patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy. We'd love to get people supporting that as we make the transition from radio after 10 years to doing this on podcast-only format.